This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when movie characters often broke out into song, and those songs were written by some of the best songwriters of the 20th century, like the Gershwins, Irving Berlin, and Harold Arlen. My guest, Philip Furia, writes about songs from movie musicals, as well as theme songs from dramatic films, in his new book, The Songs of Hollywood. Furia is also the author of The Poets of Tin Pan Alley and Skylark, The Life and Times of Johnny Mercer. He's a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. The Songs of Hollywood is co-authored by Laurie Patterson. Let's start with one of the most famous songs from one of the most famous Hollywood musicals. Here's Gene Kelly.
Singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain.
Philip Furia, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
As you point out in your book, songs for Hollywood movies have always played second fiddle to songs from Broadway musicals. Why is that?
In a Broadway musical, the songwriters were really central to the production right from the beginning. They worked with the playwright, they worked with the director, the choreographers, and they were in on where the songs were going to go in the show and who was going to do them and if new songs needed to be added. And very often on opening night, their names were on the marquee. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, or George and Ira Gershwin's Strike Up the Band. But in Hollywood, songwriters were just part of the whole production machine. They had very little say in how their songs were used. They were not brought in on conferences with the screenwriter, with the director, with the choreographer. They were just put in little bungalows and told to write songs. They really didn't have much say in how the songs were used in the films.
When you say that in movie musicals, the songwriters were told just, like, write songs, write hits, and that they weren't integral to the shaping of the musical the way Broadway songwriters were, that was in part because of the nature of the movie musicals. And the songs weren't integral in most of the movie musicals to the story itself. Do you want to explain?
Yeah, historically what happened was when they first began to present songs in movies with The Jazz Singer in 1927, starring Al Jolson, studios realized that the addition of sound made movies very realistic. You know, silent movies had transported audiences to another world where, you know, for one thing, people didn't talk out loud. But when sound came in, the movies became almost painfully realistic. And studios worried that if people suddenly burst into song the way they did in a stage musical, audiences would just find that ludicrous. So their solution to presenting a song in a movie was to make it a performance, have someone putting on a Broadway show or have somebody singing in a nightclub. Hence, The Jazz Singer is about a professional singer, and he sings because he's performing or rehearsing.
Yeah, there are lots of exceptions, like in a lot of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies.
Oh, yeah.
Even a song like A Fine Romance, they're sitting on a bench in the park talking about their relationship, and they break out into that song.
Yeah, well, that's what I really love about the movie musicals, the ones that don't present songs as performances, but as they are presented in a stage musical, as an expression of what a character feels, and presented as conversation, a duet between two characters that, you know, is part talk and part song. But that took a while for Hollywood to figure out. They started doing that in the early 30s, first actually with Maurice Chevalier. There was something about the fact that he was European that made it seem more realistic that he could suddenly go from talking into singing, you know, because they do that in Europe, I guess.
That's right. They're so romantic in Europe.
Yeah, they just burst into song. And so it, you know, it didn't strain the realism of the piece. But it, you're right. It's when Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers began making movies at RKO in the mid-1930s that they established the principle that ordinary characters could argue in song or, you know, romance each other in song. And audiences began to accept that convention.
Do you have a favorite Astaire Rogers example of them breaking into song naturally from the conversation?
Well, the one you mentioned, A Fine Romance, is a great example of that, where they're quarreling and the quarrel leads into a song, and a song where they don't dance, which is unusual for an Astaire Rogers musical. The music is by Jerome Kern and has a wonderful lyric by Dorothy Fields, where she has clever rhymes, fellow and jello. And we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes, but you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. Just a delightful lyric.
Well, why don't we hear it?
A fine romance with no kisses. A fine romance, my friend. This is, we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes. But you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. A fine romance, you won't nestle. A fine romance, you won't wrestle. I've never mussed the crease in your blue serge pants. I never had the chance. This is a fine romance. A fine romance, my good fellow, you take romance, I'll take jello. You're calmer than the seals in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. A fine romance with no quarrels, with no insults. All the morals, you're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. I never get the chance. This is a fine romance.
So that's Ginger Rogers from the movie Swing Time. My guest is Philip Furia, and his new book is called The Songs of Hollywood. The kind of singing in movies was different from the kind of singing on Broadway before Broadway singers could mic themselves. Like now on Broadway, you can sing in a small voice because you're mic'd. You couldn't do that until relatively recently. Broadway singers were not mic'd. So what was the difference between how film singers could sing and Broadway singers, and how did that change the kind of songs that were written for movie musicals?
Well, Gene Kelly once said that he had an advantage over people who could really sing because he could talk his way through a song. And that really became the style in the 1930s, where you have someone who's not really a professional singer like Fred Astaire kind of chatting his way through a song. And the fact that they had developed this system of pre-recording and playback, where they would record the songs in the studio singing into a microphone. So the song could be much more intimate and casual, much more conversational. And then when they did the song on the set, they would lip sync to a playback of the recording they'd done in the studio. So we can see all those singers in the 1930s and 1940s. I always think of Donald O'Connor in Singing in the Rain, where he does Make 'em Laugh and he's bouncing all over the room. He's lip-syncing to his own pre-recorded performance so that they could make the song seem even more casual, more nonchalant. And that established a style of presenting song in film where it's almost as if the characters are talking to each other.
You know, in talking about that style of casual talk singing, one of my favorite examples of that, which I know from your book is one of your favorite examples of that, is Bob Hope and Shirley Rost from the big broadcast of 1938 singing Thanks for the Memory.
Oh, yes, I love that scene and that song.
And I'd like you to talk about what makes this song so special.
Well, the song is by, again, Hollywood songwriters that most people probably have never heard of. Leo Robin was the lyricist, and Ralph Ranger was the composer. And the producer came to them and said, you know, we've got this new star, Bob Hope, and he's going to be in a movie, and it's going to be a song about divorce. Well, 1938, you know, divorce is still a pretty touchy subject. And they said, the producer said to the songwriters, write a song about a divorced couple that still is in love with each other but can't really acknowledge the fact that they're still in love. And they're going to be on an ocean liner sitting at a bar, and they're going to sing to each other. But Hope is a comedian, so make sure the song is funny too. So you can imagine these poor songwriters, you know, write a funny song about divorce. And they came up with this delightful, it would be called in the 1930s, a list song or a catalog song, which consists of, you know, one image, one allusion after another in a great big long list of images. The song is done with Hope and Shirley Ross sitting at a bar, and they part talk it and they part sing it as they go through the memories of the days when they were married. And the song is witty and clever, and yet underneath it, Leo Robin, the lyricist, manages to suggest that these are two very sophisticated people whose veneer of sophistication won't let them show their real feelings until the very end, when Shirley Ross breaks down in tears and runs off. So it's a very moving performance, and again, very much in the Hollywood style of a conversational kind of song.
Yeah, they talk and sing this. Yeah, I love this. So let's hear Thanks from the Memory. This is great. Bob Hope and Shirley Ross.
So thanks for the memory of crap games on the floor.
Nights in Singapore. You might have been a headache, but you never were a bore.
I thank you so much.
Thanks for the memory of China's funny walls, transatlantic calls.
That weekend at Niagara when we hardly saw the falls.
How lovely that was.
Thank you.
Thanks for the memory of lunch from 12 to 4, sunburn at the shore, that pair of gay pajamas that you bought and never wore.
Say, by the way, what did happen to those pajamas? Huh?
Letters with sweet little secrets that couldn't be put in a day wire.
Too bad it all had to go haywire. That's life, I guess. I love your dress.
Do you?
It's pretty.
Thanks for the memory of faults that you forgave, rainbows on a wave,
and stockings in the basin when a fellow needs a shave. I thank you so much.
Thanks for the memory.
That's Bob Hope and Shirley Ross singing Thanks for the Memory from the big broadcast of 1938. My guest is Philip Furia, co-author of the new book, The Songs of Hollywood. That song became Bob Hope's theme song.
Yes. Most people misquote the title. They call it Thanks for the Memories, but it's Thanks for the Memory. But yeah, always associated with him, but very few people, I think, have seen the movie.
So sometimes songs were worked into dramatic films. Films that weren't musicals. And was that sometimes because the studio owned the rights to the song?
Oh,
wanted
yes.
to make money from it?
Oh, yes. When sound movies came out in the late 1920s, a lot of the studios, particularly Warner Brothers, bought up the old sheet music publishing firms that used to be known as Tin Pan Alley.
Oh.
Because they wanted that catalog of songs. They figured songs that have proven their popularity, that they would own these songs and they would stick them in a movie. Probably the most famous example of that is Warner Brothers stuck the song As Time Goes By, which was written way back in 1931, into the 1942 movie Casablanca. One guy who loved the song when it came out in the 1930s was the author of a play called They All Come to Rick's, which was the basis of Casablanca. And he had used the song in the play. So when Warner Brothers took the play, they thought, well, they're already using that song As Time Goes By, and hey, we own the song. And they thought, well, that was a popular song. We'll make it popular again and sell some sheet music and some records of As Time Goes By, and the song will help popularize the movie. Nobody thought the song was very good when they made Casablanca. In fact, the guy who scored the movie thought it was terrible, and he said, I can write a better song than that, and actually wrote one, and they were going to refilm the scene with Ingrid Bergman and Dooley Wilson, who played the piano and sang it. But Ingrid Bergman had already cut her hair off to play Maria in For Whom the Bell Tolls. So the song was saved by a haircut, and it turned out to be enormously popular all over again.
So why don't we hear the song performed by Dooley Wilson?
Wonderful.
Play it once, Sam, for old time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play As Time Goes By.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you. Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say,
That's Dooley Wilson singing and playing piano from the movie Casablanca. My guest is Philip Furio, author of the new book, The Songs of Hollywood. There's a great example of a Hollywood studio working a song into a movie because they owned the rights to it, and a movie that is so not a musical. I'm thinking of Key Largo.
And oh, wonderful scene, yeah.
Tell us the story behind the song in that movie. I mean, this is a movie where people are basically held hostage on an island during a storm.
Yeah, a wonderful use of a song in a dramatic film is in the movie Key Largo, where Claire Trevor sings the song Moanin' Low. She's the moll, the girlfriend of Edward G. Robinson, who, as always, plays, you know, a notorious criminal. And she's also become an alcoholic, and she's begging him for a drink in the bar in Key Largo as he is holding Humphrey Bogart and Lorraine Bacall and other people hostage under gunpoint, he and his henchmen. And he says, you can have a drink if you sing that song you used to sing when you were on Broadway. And she says, do I have to sing it without accompaniment? And he said, yeah, just get up and sing. So she starts singing Moanin' Low. And it's a wonderful song about a woman who's trapped in a relationship with a very cruel man. And as she's singing it, performing the song, you see her realize that that's exactly her real life situation, that she's trapped to in a relationship with Edward G. Robinson. And that realization has her slowly break down, and her voice falters, and she sings off key. And after she finishes, she asks for the drink, and Robinson says, you are lousy, and he won't give her one. And Bogart walks over under gunpoint, goes over to the bar, pours her a stiff drink, walks it over and gives it to her, says, you deserve this. So it's just a great dramatic scene, but it's a wonderful use of a song in a non-musical picture. She won a Best Supporting Actress Award based purely, I think, on that performance of a song.
So let's hear that scene with the song from the movie Key Largo.
My gowns were gorgeous, always low-cut, very décolleté. I wore hardly any makeup, just some lipsticks, that's all. No lights, just a baby spot. I wouldn't have any entrance. They'd play the intro in the dark, and a spot would come on, and there I'd be.
Well, go ahead, sing.
Moaning low, my sweet man, I love him so. Though he's mean as can be, he's the kind of man, he's the kind of woman like me.
gonna die if sweet man should pass me by. If I die, where'll he be? He's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me. Don't know any reason why he treats me so poorly.
That's Claire Trevor singing Moon and Low from the movie Key Largo. My guest, Philip Furia, is the co-author of the book, The Songs of Hollywood. Now, although a lot of Hollywood songs are written differently than Broadway songs, and although the role of the Hollywood songwriter was different than the Broadway songwriter, at some point a lot of Broadway musicals were adapted for the screen. And so the Broadway musical became transposed for movies. What do you think worked and what didn't work? Like in the, I guess it was in the 50s that this phenomenon really bloomed.
Right. In the 1950s, television moved into the American home, and it really took business away from Hollywood. And studios had to cut back on the number of movies they made, and the most expensive kind of movie to make is the musical, where you have to have dancers, musicians, songwriters, choreographers. And so Hollywood, when they made a musical, took the safe route of making a film version of a Broadway musical that had already proven successful, rather than do what they'd done in the 30s and 40s, and that is make original film musicals like 42nd Street and Meet Me in St. Louis. Those are originally done as Hollywood movies. But things like Oklahoma and The King and I and South Pacific were just film adaptations of Broadway shows, and I frankly find most of them pretty boring.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Oh, good. I don't know. Most people adore them and get very irritated when I say that, because I say, you know, I'm writing about movie musicals, and they say, oh, I love West Side Story. And I said, well, that's not a movie musical. That's a Broadway musical that was turned into a movie. And usually when that happens, you get the worst of both worlds.
Well, I love West Side Story, so I love the movie adaptation of it, so I'm going to leave that one out of.
But, okay.
But a lot of the Rodgers and Hammerstein adaptations, like the songs just schlep on, and there's so much talking
right
in between. And
They're very stagey. I mean, these were successful stage musicals. What makes it even worse sometimes is that some of them are dubbed, you know, like Audrey Hepburn, poor Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. You know, she's so sweet and fragile looking, and yet she's dubbed by this operatic singer, Marnie Nixon. And so a little Audrey Hepburn comes this booming voice. But the fact that people love them, I think, is a tribute to how great the stage musical was, that even in a canned film version, it can still move audiences.
Well, you know, you mentioned Audrey Hepburn being dubbed by Marnie Nixon for My Fair Lady. In the film Funny Face, in which she co-starred with Fred Astaire in 1957, she sings for herself, and she has such a lovely voice. Well, why don't we end by hearing that for people who haven't heard Audrey Hepburn sing in her own voice, although probably a lot of people heard her sing a little bit in Breakfast at Tiffany's. So this is her singing the Gershwin song, How Long Has This Been Going On? Do you like this version of it?
Oh, yes. I love it. Again, you're talking about a song in a movie that's presented more conversationally, and like Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, not by someone who's a professional stage singer, but an ordinary person just breaking into song.
Philip Furia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Philip Furia is the co-author of The Songs of Hollywood.
I must find why my mind is behaving like a dancer. What's the clue to pursue? For I have to have the answer. I could cry salty tears. Where have I been all these years? Is it fun, or should I run? How long has this been going on?
You can read an excerpt of Philip Furia's book, The Songs of Hollywood, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I feel that I could melt into heaven. I'm hurled. I know how Columbus felt finding another world. Can I trust how I feel? Is this my Achilles heel? Look at me, I'm all at sea.